White House and ambassadorial retinue. It will only be the latest setback for U.S. war policy that was already careening off the track like a runaway freight train. If McChrystal is allowed to remain in his post, dictating the battlefield direction of what is now Obama's failed war in Afghanistan, then Pakistan as well, the president will appear to be even more of a wimp than he has to date, which, believe me, has taken some doing. What this all might mean to the peoples of Afghanistan and Pakistan, and to those whose taxes have paid for a decade of death and destruction, will be one of the topics I will be taking up with Gareth Porter of the Interpress News Service about 20 minutes past the hour. First, I want to share with you one of the most gratifying experiences that I have had in many decades of political activism. It began this past Sunday about 5:30 a.m., when after walking a mile from the parking lot of the West Oakland BART station with friends, we descended an overpass to find some 700 to 1,000 fellow activists already engaged in picketing the entrances to Dock 58, where an Israeli commercial freighter, the Zin Shenzhen, was scheduled to anchor that afternoon. We were there to answer the call of a newly formed labor coalition in solidarity with the people of Palestine, and our goal was to prevent dock workers from the ILWU Local 10 from entering the area to unload the cargo when the ship arrived. This was not a difficult challenge, since the labor councils of both San Francisco and Alameda counties had passed resolutions condemning Israel's bloody attack on the Gaza flotilla on June 1st and had circulated information about the picket action to their members. It was a joyous act of collusion on both sides. All that was necessary was for a sufficient number of picketers to show up to bar the workers from entering their work area, and an arbitrator would declare the situation unsafe for the workers to proceed. Knowing the script in advance, most of the dock workers stayed home, and those who didn't joined the picket line. The idea was to keep the ship from being unloaded until the next day, which, unlike a protest at the Israeli consulate or a march on Market Street, would hit the pocketbook of the Israelis and hit it deeply. I suspect that the likelihood that such pickets will become commonplace, not only in Oakland, but in L.A. and Seattle, where Zim ships laden with merchandise drop anchor, must be a frightening prospect for Israel and its American agents. Why Sunday's picket was particularly gratifying for me requires letting you in on a little history that is as important as today's news, because it provides an insight to how far we have traveled and how much further we have to go. In 1986, Dianne Feinstein, then mayor of San Francisco, made one of her rare errors of political judgment. She went to Leningrad and announced triumphantly upon her return that she had signed a sister city agreement between San Francisco and Leningrad, and an agreement for Soviet freighters to deliver goods to the port of San Francisco. Since this was during the Cold War, mind you, with the Soviets, Mayor Feinstein's declaration was not well received, to put it mildly. She was blasted not only for making a friendly gesture to America's sworn enemy, but because she had never once visited Israel. Now, Feinstein is not considered Jewish under Jewish law, while her father, from whom she inherited her last name, was Jewish, as is her husband. Her mother was not. But not letting that technically stand in her way, Feinstein promptly canceled the agreements with the Soviet Union and jumped on the next plane to Israel. Upon returning, she proudly announced, to great applause, that she had signed a sister city agreement between Haifa and San Francisco, as well as a contract for the Zim Line ships to service the port of San Francisco. There was only one hitch in all of this. The city's board of directors had just passed an ordinance prohibiting the city from doing business with any company that did business with apartheid South Africa, something Zin had been doing for years. But all it took for the city's supervisors to ignore this, however, was for the vice president of Zim's California headquarters, Dov Teitler, to write a letter stating, quote, categorically, this company has no service to South Africa for carriage of cargo either to or from that nation, end quote. Since no clerk had been assigned to verify whether or not Mr. Teitler was lying, I undertook the job myself, even though I lived in Marin County. What I did was telephone Zim's agency in Durban and Cape Town in South Africa and had them confirm that the company had biweekly freighter sailings between South Africa and Israel, and calls to Zim's offices in New York, Toronto, and Houston further confirmed this. I should add that I recorded all these phone conversations, dutifully transcribed them, and sent a copy to each San Francisco supervisor before they took a formal vote on whether or not to approve the Zim contract. One of its more outspoken members at the time, Harry Britt, held up a copy of the phone transcripts and boldly declared, quote, "We are talking about a very notorious trafficker with South Africa. I'm disappointed our port would do this kind of business," end quote. Well, when it comes to Israel, as we have seen, the truth is the first casualty. Led by judge-to-be Quentin Kopp, who had previously served a stint as a volunteer in the Israeli army, the board ignored the facts and approved the contract by a 9-2 vote. I then set out on a one-person campaign to get the world to recognize them for its violations of South African sanctions, even if the city of San Francisco did not. On the basis of my phone transcripts, Zim became the first Israeli company to be listed by the Investor Responsibility Research Center, the IRRC, as doing business with apartheid South Africa. That was 1987. In 1988, the newly formed Labor Committee on the Middle East, of which I was a co-founder, called for a picket of a Zim freighter arriving in San Francisco. About 25 people showed up, and the dock workers with a friendly wave ignored it. 22 years later, this past Sunday, our early efforts were vindicated, and it bothered me only slightly to see some labor activists who would not support us back then patting themselves on the back for bringing out the crowd for what was clearly an historic event. But the picket would never have taken place. The story of the Gaza flotilla would not have made the world's headlines had not those 9 brave men on the Turkish ship Mavi Marmara fought back and given their lives when their ship came under attack by Israeli commandos. They were true heroes who should never be forgotten, for their actions may have finally stirred the world to act against Israeli injustice. Certainly it has caused a major fissure in relations between Israel and its longtime ally Turkey, and that widening break has impacted the relations between Washington and Ankara, which American presidents and its top military men have seen as America's most important ally in the region going back to the end of World War II. What is making life difficult today for the Obama administration and the Pentagon, who would like to smooth that breach, is that Tel Aviv has called into action its foremost weapon, the United States Congress, and that body which seemed devoted to Turkey as long as it kissed Israel's behind, has now turned on Ankara with a vengeance. Thus far, 100 members of the House and 17 senators, plus Vice President Joe Biden, have submitted statements to AIPAC praising Israel and justifying its actions. On June 17th, Ted Poe from Texas and Gary Peters from Michigan, Republican and Democrat, doesn't matter which, initiated a letter to Obama, apparently drafted by AIPAC, that has been now signed by 315 House members. It offers the lower house's full endorsement for Israel's blockade of Gaza and its acts of piracy and kidnapping in international waters. I am pleased to tell you that Mike Thompson was not one of the signatories. A similar letter being circulated by Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and his Republican counterpart, Mitch McConnell, has thus far attracted 85 signatures. That letter also called for placing the Turkish charity that was responsible for the Mavi Marmara on the list of organizations that the State Department has deemed to be terrorist without the slightest suggestion of due process. This is only lesser in degree than what this nation went through from the beginning of the Cold War to the early 60s, when hundreds of organizations were arbitrarily placed on what was called the Attorney General's list because he was the one who made the decisions. In order to get a respectable job in virtually every industry, but particularly so in the media and teaching positions at all grade levels, prospective job hunters were obliged to sign an oath under penalty of perjury stating that they had never been a member of the Communist Party or any of one of hundreds of left organizations, that they didn't know anyone who was, that they had never attended a meeting of any of these organizations nor subscribed to any of their publications. Because the alleged terrorist organizations of today are based overseas, many being charities, the government does not make membership a criteria for prosecution. Simply providing assistance in any way is considered a crime even when the donor is unaware the recipient charity is on the terrorist list. This is what the Supreme Court decided was constitutional on Monday. In a 6-3 decision, the majority, including outgoing Justice Stevens, agreed that the nation's need to guard itself against terrorism was greater than the right of American citizens to freedom of speech and association. This is not just the position of the court's right-wing majority. It is also that of President Obama, whose Solicitor General is now a Supreme Court nominee, Elena Kagan. Appearing before the court in February, Kagan defended the law and urged a broad interpretation that would even allow prosecution of a U.S. citizen who filed a legal brief on behalf of a terrorist organization. Sounding just like an Israeli politician, Kagan told the court, quote, "What Congress decided is that when you help Hezbollah build homes, you are also helping Hezbollah build bombs," end quote. She might have been referring to ex-President Jimmy Carter, who has met with both Hamas and Hezbollah leaders and encouraged both the U.S. and Israel to deal with them. Let's close this segment with another look at Helen Thomas, the Dean of White House and American Women Journalists. The 89-year-old Thomas, who was my guest on Takes on the World 2 months ago, was viciously vilified by the Washington Press Corps and forced to resign from her job as a columnist with the Rehearst Press when some poorly chosen words spoken into a camera thrust in her face by a Washington rabbi were posted by the rabbi on YouTube. While the pundits outdid themselves piling on a woman who dared to speak the hard questions to presidents and their spokespersons that the male reporters lacked the guts to do, others, not part of the mainstream media, rallied to Thomas's defense. One of them was Ralph Nader, and here is 3 minutes of a longer interview he gave to Paul Jay on the Real News site. So let's go to that.
Thanks, Paul. So what's your take on what happened?
She should be reinstated. She's a courageous journalist. She came here in 1942, blazed the way for women like no one did. The first president of the Correspondents Association, White House Correspondents, head of the Gridiron Dinner, she demanded that all these doors that were closed to females be opened up. And she was the courageous pioneer. She also set a standard for journalism, asking the tough questions on the minds of most Americans that the weak-kneed White House press corps would never ask, like to Bush, Why'd you invade Iraq? A million people have died, etc. She would ask questions that started with why, and that's almost a taboo in the White House press corps. You know, you ask softball questions, but you don't ask questions about violating international law, violating our Constitution, violating our statutes, questions dealing with torture, with surveillance of Americans without a court review. And she also asked questions about the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Now, she's sitting on a bench in the White House during Jewish Heritage Week, and a rabbi comes up, and he said, "Hi, Helen, what do you think about journalism?" She says, "It's a great profession, you can't lose, young people should go into it, everybody learns." He said, "What do you think about Israel?" She said, "Well, they should get out of Palestine." Hardly a controversial statement. The UN resolutions say that they should get out of the West Bank and Gaza, 242 and
okay,
so on.
But
and then he asks her, "Well, what would they do?" And that's when she said something, which I don't think she believes. She apologized right away. She said something that basically was an offhand comment, like a lot of people make an offhand comment. You know how many people we've all heard in the Washington press corps privately, she didn't do this part of her job, this is offhand comment, say bad things about Arabs? Anti-Semitism against Arabs is rife in politics today. Not just talk radio. I mean, you got Savage, you got Hannity, you got Limbo. I mean, the things they say about Muslims and Muslim Americans. And how about Ann Coulter? She didn't lose a $30,000 speech. She didn't lose any gig. She didn't lose her column. And she said horrific things about going over there and slaughtering Muslims. So if they can't be converted to Christianity, she added that point. So, I mean, one mistake like that, which she apologized for, and they terminated her column, they terminated her career, they're going to replace her in the White House press corps. It's like a professional execution. And now the polls, I'm told, are highly in favor of her coming back.
Yeah, there's a Washington Post poll yesterday,
yeah,
which showed 88% of the people were opposed to her removal from the White House press corps.
And that was Ralph Nader talking about Helen Thomas. And when you notice at the end that Nader's opinion was not a minority opinion, after that Washington Post poll, or after this was recorded, the Washington Post poll continued to be online. And after 22,000 votes, it was 91% of them said that Thomas should not have been forced to resign. And what did the Washington Post do then? Well, they gave the Rabbi Nessendorf, who asked Thomas the question that brought an end to her career, to do an online Ask the Rabbi column. My guest today, Dr. Gareth Porter, is a veteran diplomatic historian and journalist specializing in U.S. national security policy. He has been writing regularly on American policy toward Iraq and Iran for Interpress News Service, for one of the most reliable sources of information analysis about that corner of the world entered our lives in such a big way after 9/11. We last spoke with him in October, and when I was looking for a reliable source of information about what was happening actually in Turkey, I called him, and the last time I spoke, the board was lit up with your phone calls, and you'll have a chance to do that again later in the program. But now, welcome once again, Gareth Porter, to Takes on the World.
Thanks very much for having me.
When I contacted you last week, as I mentioned, to be my guest, I was primarily interested in talking about Turkey and how its widening breach with Israel was going to affect U.S. policy in the region. And since Turkey's been a long-time U.S. asset, but now the loose lips of General McChrystal has intruded into the scene, and by now President Obama may be looking for a new general to take over what seems to be a failed policy in Afghanistan. What's your take on this?
I think you're right. I think that it seems to me very, very likely that he will, in fact, fire General McChrystal. I think he has very little choice but to do so. The refusal or the failure to fire McChrystal, I think, would reinforce the impression that he has lost control of his own policy and contribute to a more serious drift in the policy, in the implementation of the policy in Afghanistan, even more serious than I think what we've already seen. So that would surely be apparent to both the president and his advisors. I find it hard to believe that he won't end up announcing today that he is indeed firing General McChrystal.
Well, the policy in Afghanistan, I mentioned earlier, it seems like a freight train careening off a railroad track. Even before this happened, there was a build-up for an offensive this summer in Kandahar, which sounded like they were preparing for the Super Bowl. It was seeing hype so much in the media. And then they started saying, well, it wasn't going to be exactly that kind of a offensive. And Marja, which was billed before that as being a very important place for the U.S. to exert itself and take back Afghanistan, didn't seem to be going as well as expected. Is there any kind of policy that the U.S. can undertake in Afghanistan that's going to change things? Or are we learning a lesson the Russians learned?
If I were advising the White House, I would say you must seize this opportunity to really make a major shift in policy and strategy in Afghanistan, and to abandon what has clearly been shown to be a completely unrealistic set of objectives, which McChrystal had laid out to essentially kick the Taliban out of their two biggest heartland provinces, that is Kandahar and Helmand provinces, and essentially take control of a huge area of southern Afghanistan. And I think that if you basically admit that that is not a realistic objective for the United States. And the alternative that you have to then accept is that the United States must begin negotiations on a schedule for withdrawal and go back to the original aim that President Obama himself announced, particularly last November, when he emphasized that what we are doing here is aiming at excluding al-Qaeda from Afghanistan. And so the quid pro quo for U.S. withdrawal, I would suggest to the White House, would be that the Taliban must guarantee in a formal agreement and with some provisions that would allow inspection and, you know, various other ways to verify it, that al-Qaeda would never be able to operate again in Afghanistan. And I think that's a realistic aim because the Taliban has indeed communicated that they are willing to make such an agreement with the United States. They've done so on their own website in an article published last December, which was, of course, essentially ignored by the mainstream media and which the administration itself refused to respond to. But I think that that is the alternative that needs to be now embraced by the White House and pushed forward with a new team in Afghanistan.
Well, a question then comes up, how big actually is al-Qaeda? We keep hearing administration spokespeople talk about al-Qaeda, but the fight goes on against the Taliban as if it's like a bait and switch, and it's like...
Well, I think there is something to that. I think that's correct, that essentially the White House told the American people we're fighting in Afghanistan to destroy, disrupt, and destroy al-Qaeda, whereas, in fact, what has been happening is that the U.S. military is doing what it knows how to do, and that is to carry out a war against, you know, folks within Afghanistan, that is the Taliban, who can be identified and who represent a major challenge. Now, al-Qaeda, you asked how many al-Qaeda there are in Afghanistan. I mean, the last time we heard anything about that, it was from 100 to 300. I think the upper end of that estimate was far too large. And I think, you know, closer to 100 is certainly realistic. And these are people that go back and forth between their redoubts in Pakistan and operations in Afghanistan. They are not permanently stationed there by any means. And so I think we should be prepared to take advantage of the fact that the Afghan Taliban do not see eye to eye with al-Qaeda. They have very different interests, very different views of the world. Al-Qaeda's interest is global jihad, jihad that would be directed against not just the United States and the West, but countries like China and Russia are also the objective of jihad as far as al-Qaeda is concerned. The Taliban, on the other hand, the Afghan Taliban, have no interest in global jihad. Their interest is to gain power in Afghanistan itself and to have a regime guided by Sharia law, and they've been very explicit about that.
And they are backed to some degree by some elements in the Pakistan intelligence services.
That is correct. No question about it. There's no ambiguity about it. It's now been more or less, I think, conceded by the Obama administration that is the case, even though last year they were trying to carry out the pretense or act on the pretense that ISI had somehow now turned a corner and were thoroughly in our corner against the Taliban insurgency in Afghanistan. I don't think that anyone would dare to stand up in public and say anything along those lines anymore.
Well, it's interesting. The American public isn't aware of it, but one of the concerns that Pakistan has is the infiltration of elements from India, governmental infiltration by India in Afghanistan, including the opening up of a number of consulates when there's no Indian population there to serve them, and that the support by Pakistan of the Taliban in Afghanistan is a way of fighting India on another level, a proxy war.
Yes, the Pakistani officials, not just ISI, but civilian officials as well, are quite explicit about their perception of the situation in Afghanistan as one in which their main fear is Indian gaining of influence with a regime, that is to say the Karzai regime, that has in fact had very close relations with India in the past and at present. And they are very clearly making the demand of Karzai that any settlement will have to involve a commitment by the new government, the government that emerges from this settlement, to essentially reducing the Indian presence to a minimum. And I think that is clearly at the center of the Pakistani interest and the Pakistani policy in terms of pushing forward a political military settlement in Afghanistan.
Now, Karzai is made to appear here as somewhat of a loose cannon, and saying statements that were there not an internet, he might not even be alive today. It's been compared to Diem, who was negotiating with the North in the Vietnam War, who was assassinated with U.S. complicity. Karzai seems to have a charmed life at the moment. He's playing every side against each other and at the same time, and he seems to be surviving.
Well, you've drawn a very interesting and I think useful parallel between Karzai and Diem, because it's true. They were both essentially allies of the United States and dependent on the United States military presence to a great extent, and at the same time committed to a negotiated settlement with the with the very adversary that the United States was fighting. And of course, as you point out, Diem was eliminated with the complicity of the CIA and the U.S. The government, the Kennedy administration. On the other hand, Karzai does seem to be getting away with this, and I think that is a very revealing indication of just how the situation in Afghanistan is so completely unfriendly to a military approach, to an approach that relies on U.S. military forces there to play a useful role. I mean, the fact is that the politics and the society of Afghanistan, particularly southern Afghanistan, are so hostile to the presence of foreign troops and any effort to use military force against the Taliban that it is impossible to see how the United States can continue to use military force in any way that is going to even contribute to eventual settlement. I mean, I think that it is absolutely true that the withdrawal of the troops is more likely to foster a settlement, to begin the withdrawal of the troops is more likely to support a settlement than to fail to do so. Because of that peculiar set of circumstances, that is, the Taliban are so strong in southern Afghanistan, and the population, in part, of course, because of the presence of the Taliban and their ability and readiness to take revenge against people who collaborate with foreign troops, but also because they regard the Taliban as indeed fellow Pashtun patriots rather than real enemies. That they are simply not going to cooperate in any effort to try to weaken, much less eliminate, the Taliban.
Well, when they were announcing beginning to announce the big offensive in Kandahar, there was a large Jirga meeting held that Karzai held with leaders in Kandahar, which McChrystal attended, in which they were emphatically against a military offensive by the U.S. And Karzai said, "Well, we'll listen to you." And it doesn't seem, although U.S. casualties are rising dramatically every day, not only U.S. casualties, but NATO casualties, that this has been a fiasco thus far.
Well, that's exactly right. And what is so interesting is that I actually believed that McChrystal intended to ignore the warnings of the assembled notables, the assembled leadership in Kandahar that you referred to. I believe it was April 5th, And to go ahead and introduce large-scale U.S. Forces into Kandahar. It now appears, however, that he really has gotten the message that the population is so opposed to the U.S. And foreign troop presence in Kandahar City in particular, that he is, in fact, going to avoid that. Now, he may not avoid it completely, but I think that that he has been so impressed by the determination, the resistance, strong resistance of the Kandaharis to a foreign military presence, that he has seen no choice but to go along with that. And I think that is an extremely important indicator that the McChrystal strategy simply is unworkable. It is absolutely unrealistic. It is out of line with the most fundamental realities of the situation in both Kandahar and in Helmand province. And I think it's worthwhile just to very briefly reflect on the degree of failure that we now understand took place in Marja, in that campaign that began last February. And I have pointed this out. I haven't seen anyone else pick up on this point. But if you look at the number of troops that were used in the Marja offensive, and it was either 7,500 U.S. and British troops, or it was closer to 15,000 if you include Afghan troops that were at least said to be involved in the offensive. And then you look at the real population of Marja, which is about 35,000, according to the best estimate that I've been able to come up with, based on actually looking at a segment of the entire area, a 1.2 kilometer segment on Google Earth images, and trying to use that as the basis for the estimate. It's about 35,000 civilian population. Now, that means that the troop-to-population ratio was either roughly 1 to 2 or, at worst, 1 to 4. That is absolutely unheard of. You simply cannot expect to have that kind of troop-to-population ratio in any normal circumstance, because there simply aren't enough troops. And nevertheless, despite that totally unrealistic 1-to-2 or 1-to-4 ratio, of course, we know that the Taliban were not eliminated from Marja, from this rural area, farming area, not a city, as was claimed by the U.S. Marines in their briefings for the media and was picked up by the media. It's really an incredibly powerful piece of evidence of the utter failure of the strategy, that one to two or 1-to-4 ratio of troops to population could not root out the Taliban from this district-sized area. And in fact, we know that the population of Marja is now refusing to cooperate with the American and other foreign troops, basically shunning them, indicating that the Taliban still essentially holds sway in that area.
My guest is Dr. Gareth Porter, and we're talking about Afghanistan and the region, and General McChrystal's trip to the woodshed today, the White House woodshed. This all comes on top of latest reports, how U.S. contractors have been paying off the Taliban for protection. And the report, suddenly we find out that there's at least $1 trillion worth of minerals in Afghanistan, which I guess makes the country worth fighting for. I mean, it's like they keep trying to come up with something to justify a U.S. presence there, and it doesn't seem to be working.
Well, let's start with that story first of all, because it is so obviously, as you've indicated, a ploy to try to bolster public support for the war in Afghanistan at the moment when it is obviously most vulnerable, that is, the war is most vulnerable to a meltdown of political support. I think there's signs that that's already happening, and the momentum certainly is very powerfully in that direction. And I think it's really quite a pathetic argument to be making at this point, that there's this fabulous wealth under the earth in Afghanistan, and therefore, we ought to really just stay there. I mean, even the most hardened pro-war person would have a hard time explaining how this would be in the U.S. interest to remain in Afghanistan in a war that makes no sense otherwise, that we can't possibly, not just cannot win, but we can't even maintain the presence there for a long time without simply suffering more casualties and without gaining anything from it. The fact is that regardless, I mean, you know, we're talking about wealth. It's not going to have any significance for many years in any case. And once it does have some significance, the question of who controls Afghanistan politically is going to make no difference in terms of where the wealth ends up being sold, where the minerals, the lithium, for example, for our computers, is going to be sold in the world. It's going to be sold to whoever is willing to pay the market price for it. It has nothing to do with political control. That's a myth that has been foisted on the American public by the U.S. military for many decades in order to sell the idea that, oh, we have to have our military forces protecting access to these resources. Obviously the same.
Such as oil,
exactly. Without that military force, we would lose access to the oil, and of course that is completely a phony argument.
That's a very, very good point. Stepping back for a moment, looking at the region, we have destabilized Pakistan. Iraq has 2 hours electricity a day. Even NPR has to have a report on what a failure the situation is in Iraq, and killings, car bombs going every day. And our most reliable ally in the region since World War II, Turkey, has now split with our I don't know how to describe Israel, but it's not a strategic asset, the more it's a liability. Turkey and Israel seem to be going their separate ways, and the killing of the Turkish sailors, a Turkish activist on the Mavi Marmara a couple of weeks ago, seems to have really energized the Turkish street. And this presents a terrific problem for Washington, because Turkey has been a real asset. It's also a member of NATO, and NATO seems to be stumbling around Afghanistan. None of the countries who have troops there, none of the people want those troops there. How do you look at the whole region? Is the United States empire really collapsing as it appears to be?
Well, I don't know if I would use the word collapsing. I mean, obviously, in the longer run, the United States military is going to have to get out of Afghanistan. It cannot remain there, despite the undoubted desire to maintain military bases in perpetuity for the foreseeable future, or even the unforeseeable future, which the U.S. military has. They're not going to be able to do that. They're not going to be able to remain in Iraq. We know that the Shia population of that country is not going to stand for it. At best, there will be, at most, the U.S. military might get a very small training mission of a few hundred trainers to train Iraqi fighter pilots and people doing high-tech, maintaining high-tech equipment that would be sold to Iraq. But beyond that, there's not going to be a combat presence in that country. I think this artificial sort of high point of U.S. military presence in the Middle East is coming to an end. So I'm not sure I would simply call it a collapse. I would simply say that it is melting away as a result of the natural political forces that have been developing in the region over a long period of time. And that the real U.S. position politically and militarily in the Middle East has been weakening for many years, from the beginning of the last decade, from 2001 on, when the U.S. suddenly went into a huge military buildup in the Middle East and Central Asia. The United States has, from the beginning, been experiencing a loss of influence that we can see over a series of a sequence of events, you know, beginning with the fact that the U.S. could not defeat the Sunni insurgency in Iraq, then experienced, you know, then figured out finally, too late, that what Iraq was really about was a struggle between Sunnis and Shia factions in that country, populations in that country, which we really did not have a stake in, had no real U.S. interest in. And in fact, what happened was we ended up strengthening the influence of and making permanent the influence of Iran in Iraq, rather than strengthening an anti-Iran influence in the country, or a pro-Western influence in the country. So you know, that those were two important events, and then you of course had the Israeli invasion of Lebanon and the Hezbollah victory over the Israelis, which strengthened anti-Western and anti-Israeli forces in the region as a whole, and you know, other events as well, which we don't have time to go into. Yeah. But basically, I think what we've seen over the past over the past decade is a continued loss of influence by the United States, reflecting the real political weakness of U.S. policy there. And of course, as you've suggested, our relationship with Israel is central, and the fact that the U.S. is steadily making more enemies in the Middle East over time rather than the opposite.
Before we went on the air, I mentioned to the listeners that there are two letters circulating in Washington to President Obama, one signed by 315 members of the House, and one by 85 senators, essentially telling Obama to stand by Israel's side against Turkey and support the blockade and against defending the attack on the Gaza flotilla. And this is obviously making Obama's position, whatever one thinks about Obama in Washington, U.S. has a strategic interest in maintaining Turkey as an ally. And you have a Congress that is trying to actually undermine that alliance because it's because the Israeli lobby has given it its marching orders.
Right, and this, you know, this is an extremely dangerous situation for the United States to be in. The fact is that the United States is pursuing policies in the Middle East to a significant degree as a reflection of domestic politics and the unwanted and untoward influence of the pro-Israeli lobby in U.S. politics. And this influence is at odds with the U.S. strategic interests in that part of the world, I would say national security interests in that part of the world. And the interesting thing is that it is now emerging increasingly that the U.S. military is very concerned about the role that Israel and the pro-Israeli lobby is playing in the formulation of U.S. policy. Petraeus has made remarks about that problem. I know for a fact that that reflects a deeper U.S. military leadership view of great concern about the degree to which the U.S. attachment to Israel has been extremely costly in U.S. national security policy, and the fact that the Turkish U.S. relationship has now suffered grievously because of the U.S. support for Israel, I think, is not only the latest but the most serious of the effects that contradiction between the interests of Israel and its supporters in this country and the interests of the United States has created in U.S. policy.
What is interesting is Anthony Cordesman, who is the talking head on NPR and Sunday talk shows, wrote a paper the other day in which he declared Israel to be a liability, and it has totally been ignored by the mainstream media, which also has a bit of influence by the same lobby.
This, of course, is the fact that sort of makes it much more difficult to make policy change in this country, which is that the news media are not objective at all, but rather have a political agenda of their own, which includes, as you suggested, support for Israel. And, I mean, this is another one of those contradictions that the U.S. political system, this extremely dysfunctional political system, is caught in. The contradiction between the change that needs to take place and the ability of certain interests in this country to prevent that change because of the propaganda that is broadcast daily, particularly by electronic media, but also the quality of press, the Washington Post and the New York Times.
Exactly. I want to go to the phones in a moment, but I want to first talk about Iran. We had Brazil and Turkey negotiate an exchange of nuclear fuel with Iran, which evidently had been encouraged by President Obama, who then turned around and, as I gather, double-crossed them in pushing for the sanctions that were passed by the UN Security Council, and now Congress is pushing for even tougher sanctions.
I think it's a bit more complicated than that. I mean, I think that what we have here is another case where you have a divided administration, an administration which is operating rather dysfunctionally, in which the White House had one view of this issue and the State Department had another. The State Department, of course, under Hillary Clinton, is extremely hawkish on the issue of Iran. And I think that it's very clear the State Department was cut out of the action completely. And the White House and the National Security Council staff was basically carrying out its own diplomacy quite separate from the State Department, which involved encouraging the Turkish and Brazilian governments, leaders, to play a role in mediating with Iran, because they did, in fact, still want to have reach an agreement on that fuel swap proposal, an agreement which I think the State Department regarded as not worthy of supporting. I mean, they felt that it should be taken off the table, but the White House was not willing to take it off the table. So I think the reality is that we have a deep split, a very profound split in the administration. I think Obama does, in fact, still want to negotiate with Iran, but he understands that he's got serious political problems, not just with the pro-Israeli lobby and Congress, which is obvious, but with his own State Department.
Well, that's an interesting take on that. The time is now 9:51, and the number here is 895-2448 or 1-800-499-7117 if you have a call or a question or a comment for my guest, Dr. Gareth Porter. The challenging of the U.S., for example, by Turkey and Brazil, their willingness, Turkey's is making a major move to actually replace Iran, which Ahmadinejad was trying to play a role. But Turkey seems to have now been trying to regain lost splendor from the Ottoman Empire by being the country that the Middle East looks to, the larger Arab population looks to for leadership. How do you see that developing?
Well, I would say two things. One, of course, you know, the idea that that Turkey is now trying to replay its role as an empire from the past is one that that those who have been hostile to the new Turkish policy have tried to play up. I mean, this is a line that you're beginning to see from pro-Israeli people and people within Israel itself are propagandizing to that effect, and I think that is not a very useful way to think about what Turkey's doing at this point. I mean, the fact is that Turkey is a modern nation state, the 16th largest economy in the world, part of NATO, has no intention of getting out of NATO unless the Israelis somehow are able to maneuver them out by using their political clout in the United States and Europe. So Turkey is very firmly established in the modern world as part of the global economy. It is also an Islamic country, but it is a Sunni country which wishes to enjoy good relations with all other Islamic states, and it is not at this point threatening to use military force, except in one place, and that is in Kurdistan, the Kurdistan part of Iraq, where Turkey is subject to, has been the victim of attacks by the Turkish Workers' Party, the KPP, and the United States and Kurdistan have both promised to do something to prevent that, and have failed to do so. And so there is real reason to believe that, that the Turks might well intervene militarily in Kurdistan as U.S. forces withdraw from Iraq. But otherwise, there's no danger here that Turkey is going to be using military force to try to create an empire. And on the Iranian side, I would say, you know, there's been a lot of talk about how the Iranians, this is a big defeat for Iran because Turkey is replacing Iran as the champion of Hamas and of the Palestinian cause. You know, no doubt the Iranians would like to be thought of as the primary champion of Hamas. But on the other hand, I doubt very much if they are really weeping over this development. I think they're much more enthusiastic about the new Turkish role in the Middle East than they are disappointed that they're being supplanted as the main champion of the Palestinians.
Well, that's a good point, because now it's not just Iran being targeted by the Israel and its Israel lobby. Now you have Turkey, and it's interesting how the U.S. continues, the lobby continues to help make enemies for the U.S. in the region. One thing that kind of is troubling is as Israel becomes more and more isolated, and since the incident in the Gulf and the attack on the Mavi Marmara seemed to have been like a tipping point for a number of people and countries in around the world. What do you think is the likelihood that they would launch a strike on Iran? Is it greater or lesser because of this?
I don't dismiss that possibility at all. I think that it's a very serious threat. Needs to be treated as serious. Needs to be discussed thoroughly. And objectively in this country, and it has not been. One of the things that, if you follow the New York Times and Washington Post closely in their coverage of this issue, it becomes apparent is that that there has been a very strong tendency on the part of the media elite and the political elite in this country to try to suggest to the American people that it's almost that's inevitable. I shouldn't say inevitable, but it's very possible that Israel will, in fact, decide to attack Iran. And should that happen, there's nothing the United States can do about it, because, as Joseph Biden said publicly last year, Israel is an independent country. They can make their own decisions. Well, that's an irrelevant comment. It doesn't reflect the reality, which is that Israel does, in fact, need U.S. Compliance with any strike against Iran. At the very minimum, it needs U.S. Overt compliance. It needs a decision by the White House to go along with the strike. If the White House does not tell the U.S. Air Force in Iraq, which controls the airspace of Iraq through which the Israelis would undoubtedly have to pass in order to attack Iran, those Israeli warplanes will be shot down as a matter of automatic practice of a standard operating procedure, without the what is called the friend or foe codes, the international friend or foe codes, the Israelis cannot go through that airspace without being shot down, or at the very least being forced to land before they go through the airspace to reach Iran. So what we have here is a situation where President Obama would have to make an affirmative decision to support the Israeli attack on Iran in order for it to succeed. And should he do that, you would have leaks at very least, and very possibly a major resistance by the U.S. military, an overt resistance by the U.S. military, which feels very strongly that this would be an extremely serious matter for U.S. interests in the region.
An act of insanity.
Exactly.
I think the problem that I have is I believe that the confidence that Israel has, unfortunately, validated, that the American Congress will back them up, and anything they do is the thing that would allow them to think they could attack Iran and get away with it.
Well, you're correct that they have been extremely overconfident about their ability to manipulate Congress and to get Congress to do whatever they want. However, on matters of war and peace, the President of the United States still makes the decisions. And on this one, you know, the President of the United States would have to weigh a lot of consequences that would certainly follow an Israeli attack on Iran. And he would do so with the full knowledge that the U.S. military leadership and the Department of Defense are, I would say, almost to a man, firmly opposed to going along with any Israeli strike against Iran.
Well, let's hope they get their way. I've come to the end of the hour. Dr. Gareth Port, I want to thank you very much for listening. My programs are now can be read online or listened to online on radioforall.org, radio number 4ALL.org, and it will be online later this afternoon. Dr. Porter, thanks so much again for being our guest on Takes on the World and sharing your knowledge with us.
Thanks very much, Jeff.
Take care.